in the second week of our summer series we're calling Character Summer. Each morning throughout the remainder of the summer, we'll be looking at a different character from the scriptures. And each of those characters is in the cross behind me. So last week we started with Daniel. And last week I told you that on some of the Sundays, we might be looking at a specific part of their story. That was the case with Daniel. We just looked at Daniel chapter 6 last week. Other weeks, we might do more of an overview of the character. And that's certainly the case this week as we look at the character Nehemiah. I'm going to encourage you to open up your Bibles to Nehemiah. If you didn't have a Bible with you, there are some in the seats in front of you or beneath you. If you don't know how to find Nehemiah, here's the easiest way. Open to the middle. You'll probably be in Psalms or Proverbs. Go backwards. You'll see Job. You'll see Esther. You'll see Nehemiah. And we're going to be doing an overview of Nehemiah this morning, but a little historical context for you for the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah lived about 5th century BC. At the time of Nehemiah, the nation of Israel had ceased to have its own sovereignty. It had been overrun years prior by the Assyrians, who were overrun by the Babylonians, who were overrun by the Persians. And so by the time you get to the 5th century BC, you've got the Persians and you've got King Artaxerxes I. This is what's happening during the time of Nehemiah. Also need to know that the city of Jerusalem, very important for this particular story, had been destroyed and was in ruins for about 140 years up until this point. Also, the leaders of Israel had been dispersed. They had been sent into exile. It was a common practice that when a nation was overrun, the leaders in that nation weren't necessarily put to death. What would happen is they would send them into exile into other parts of the kingdom. Thus, their skill set was able to be used in another part of the kingdom, but they'd been taken away from their place of influence. It's what happened in the case of Daniel. He was one of the exiles. And it's what happened with Nehemiah as well. Also, if you're reading this in the Hebrew scriptures, you'll have great difficulty finding the book of Nehemiah because the book of Nehemiah was combined with Ezra. Ezra and Nehemiah was one story. It was one book. But this morning, we're not focused on Ezra. We're going to be focused on Nehemiah, and we're going to be reading portions of the entire book. And so we're going to jump into chapter 1 and start at the very beginning. Mary Poppins said it's a very good place to start. So the words of Nehemiah, son of Hekaliah, in the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa, Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile and also about Jerusalem. Remember, the leaders had been sent into exile, but there was a remnant that remained in Israel, in the area of Jerusalem. And he's asking about them and the condition of Jerusalem. They said to me, those who survived the exile and are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates have been burned with fire. When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. And here we need to stop. This is a phrase that is repeated throughout the book of Nehemiah by Nehemiah. At least 11 times in the book of Nehemiah, you'll see that phrase. So I prayed before the God of heaven. So I prayed before the God of heaven. Last week, when we were looking at the story of Daniel, one of the things that we pointed out was this. Daniel took prayer seriously. At least 3 times a day, he got down on his knees and prayed. And last week, I made this comment, and I'll repeat it. This is not intended to be a theological or a political comment. But when it comes to the Muslims, I have great respect for their discipline in prayer. We can argue about the theology. We can all argue about the politics. But when it comes to their discipline of prayer, I have great respect for Muslim people. And then we looked at Daniel, and Daniel had that discipline of praying at least 3 times a day. And we asked the question, are we like Daniel? I suppose we could ask today, are we like Nehemiah? He prays. So I prayed before the God of heaven. What does your prayer discipline look like? Are we a praying people? And if you say yes, I get to ask, what's the evidence? Someone put a challenge out to you, and this is in no means supposed to be a call to some type of legalism. But try this for a week. Try one of the following 2 disciplines for 1 week, see what happens. You could take the Daniel challenge and set up for 1 week that you're praying 3 times a day. But be careful here. This does not mean wedge in some prayer in the midst of your schedule. No, for 1 week, try this. Set up when you're praying and rearrange your schedule around that for 1 week, 3 times a day. See what happens. Or take the Nehemiah approach. We're just going to use the number 11 because that's how many times you see it, that phrase in Nehemiah. Carry with yourself a journal. Most smartphones have a notes page on it. When you pray, jot it down that you've prayed. And see if you're praying 11 times a day. And just see what happens. Again, when we pray, it's not so much about changing the heart and mind of God. It's about God changing the heart and mind of the prayer. What would happen if we prayed like Daniel? What would happen if we prayed like Nehemiah? So I prayed before the God of heaven 11 times a day. What would that look like? Now, when you get to the end of chapter 1, you get this sentence. I was cupbearer to the king. It might seem like a throwaway line in the chapter. It's not. It's tremendously significant. Now, here's the problem. We think cupbearer. We think glorified waiter. No. There's much more to this than simply the one who brings the cup. And we think, well, he's the one that would test the cup so the king wouldn't get poisoned. That might have been one of the roles, but it's more than that. To be cupbearer before the king is a position of some honor. Not only do you have close proximity to the king, if you read through history outside of the Bible, just read your history, and you discover that cupbearers would sometimes be the carrier of the signet ring for the king. They were often a trusted advisor. There are moments in history you discover that the cupbearer was the chief financial officer. All this to say, to be cupbearer is more than a waiter. It's an important position in the kingdom. And Nehemiah was cupbearer to the king. All right, jumping to chapter 2. Chapter 2 starts out this way. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought for him, I took wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before. So the king asked me, why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart. I was very much afraid. You might be, wait. Why is he very much afraid? While the cupbearer might have had a position of significance, it did not mean that the cupbearer had license to freely speak his mind. Those who just came before the king and just said what's ever on their mind would often lose their mind. This was not something that one would recklessly do. And so when the king is suddenly asking for the opinion, hey, what's wrong? There's good reason why Nehemiah is afraid right here. Because one, if he loses favor, he's in bad shape. Or if he just speaks his mind, he could be in bad shape. But I said to the king, may the king live forever. Again, common way to address a king. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my ancestors are buried lies in ruins. We have no evidence that necessarily Nehemiah had ever been there before. He might have. He might have been in exile his whole life and brought up. We're not sure. And its gates have been destroyed by fire. The king said to me, "What is it you want?" See what happens next year. Then I prayed to the God of heaven. Remember, this comes up again. The king goes, "Hey, what do you want? What do you want?" Have you ever heard the phrase, "It's good to think before you speak"? It's a good way to live your life, quite frankly. You'll avoid all kinds of trouble if you simply think before you speak. I got a better way to live, though. Pray before you speak. This is what Nehemiah is doing. He's faced with an opportunity. He's faced with great challenge. He is faced with great sadness. Remember back in chapter 1, he was grieved. He had been mourning. So look at all the different emotions that this guy is going through. But before he speaks, he kneels and prays before the God of heaven. Pray before you speak and see what happens. I answered the king, "If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my ancestors are buried so that I can rebuild it." So he makes a request. But before he made a request, what did he do? He was praying. But then he makes a request. Then the king, with the queen sitting beside him, asked me, "How long will your journey take? And when will you get back?" It pleased the king to send me. It pleased the king to send me. It pleased the king so much that the king sends him with papers, which allow him safety and travel, but also allows him to have the means to get the resources for the project at hand. But then when you get to verses 11 and 12, it says this, "I went to Jerusalem, and after staying there 3 days, I set out during the night with a few others. I had not told anyone what my God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. There were no mounts with me except the one I was riding on." And what happens is, he gets there. He's there for a couple of days. And then during the night, he gets up and he inspects the wall. He goes around Jerusalem and does an inspection. He checks the condition of the wall, to which I have to ask this. When was the last time you inspected the condition of your wall? When was the last time you took time to check the condition of your heart, the condition of your mind, the condition of your relationships? When was the last time you carved out space to simply inspect the condition of your life? Now, I have to be honest, this is not an area that I am just prone to jump into. I tend to be, there's the wall, this is what we're doing, let's go. I am not prone to self-reflection. I have to be super intentional to go to those places. One of my best friends is really good at this. He does a great job of carving out time and space to inspect the condition of his wall. And he is encouraging me in that direction. In fact, he recently gave me a self-guided retreat that I'll be doing when I get back from vacation, because I leave for vacation this week. But when I get back from vacation, I get to go on a self-guided retreat that is all about inspecting my wall. And I love the very first paragraph in this retreat. It says this, "Life comes at us quickly. Many of us are moving at a pace so fast that we're oblivious to the true condition of our hearts and the state of our relationships. The formation we crave will never be found in a hurry. It requires each of us to slow down and have an intentional and authentic encounter with God." When was the last time you inspected your wall? Before Nehemiah started building, he did some inspecting. When was the last time you did this? My wife and I have been married for 25 years. And for almost the entirety of our marriage, we have practiced the discipline of a date night. Every week, we have a date. For the last 2 years, we haven't had a weekly date night. We've had a weekly date lunch. Every Friday is my day off. I go have lunch in my wife's classroom. It's very romantic, just the two of us and all of her kids. But then when the kids go out to play, the two of us go for a walk all the way around the school. And it's just a chance for us to check in with one another. Because we know that when that doesn't exist, the condition of our marriage wall becomes somewhat decayed. And I notice, as much as I love summer, we get out of our rhythm there and our relationship suffers. Because you got to take time to check the condition of your wall. How's your marriage? How's your relationship with your kids? How's your relationship with God? When was the last time you took time to check out your wall? Then you get to chapter 3. Chapter 3 is one of those classic, boring chapters of Scripture. It's mind-numbingly boring. You read the first two chapters. Oh, there's intrigue. There's, you know, relationship with the king, and he's praying before God, and he goes on this nighttime route around this. It's very exciting. And then you get to chapter 3, list of names. It's like, oh my goodness, so boring. But then you read it a little bit more, and you discover, wait a second. This isn't as boring as it first looks, because it lists the names of the people working on the wall and the section of the wall they're working on. But it doesn't just give their names, it gives their occupations too. And when you read the names and the occupations, suddenly you go, this is quite a construction crew. Because you look at the names on there and their occupations and you realize there are priests, there are merchants, there are perfume makers, there are goldsmiths, there are servants, there are fathers, there are sons, there are daughters, and they're all working together. Chapter 3 is amazing because what you discover is you have a diverse group of people united for a common mission. It's a diverse group of people united for a common mission. If you think, wait a second, there's not a place for me in what God is doing, you haven't read chapter 3. There's a place for you on the wall. There's a place for you in what God is wanting to accomplish. God has uniquely gifted you, has given you passions and experience that enable you to bring a unique skill set to what God is doing right here and right now. But it does not mean that we simply get to do whatever we want because this is the way we're wired. Think about this. You got the perfume maker. He's like my favorite wall builder. The perfume maker, he probably is thinking, wait a second, we're building a wall? What good am I gonna be in building a wall? I'm a perfume maker. To which Nehemiah says, oh, no. There's a place for you. There's a place for you in what God is doing here in Jerusalem. But on the flip side of it, the perfume maker doesn't get to say, I get to be part of this, but I'm going to do it the way I want to. I'm not into bricks. Those of you in my section, put the bricks down. Let's talk about what lavender can do for you. No. Building a wall might not have been the perfume maker's thing. But he was not excluded, but it also means he probably had to humble himself a little bit and go, I'm going to do something a little outside of my comfort zone right now because this is what God is doing in my midst. There's a place for you on the wall. It might require us to have a little bit of courage to step out of our comfort zone, but there's a place for you on the wall in what God is doing. Nehemiah understood this because I have no record there of him saying, no, there's no place for you, goldsmith. No, there is. There's no place for you, daughters. No, there's a place for you. Then we get to chapter 5, and you might think, Mike, wait a second, you skipped 4. Yes, and I'm coming back to it. Chapter 5 is an interesting chapter, and it reveals something about Nehemiah's character. Because during the construction of the wall, there is a segment of the population that suffers as a result. There are people in the community that are poor and are hurting. And guess what? During the construction, they suffered greatly. They go, wait a second. We're already in a bad shape. We're already hurting. And in this construction, although we are sacrificing greatly, we're now suffering even more. And Nehemiah does a wonderful thing. He stops what he's doing for a moment to address the needs of the hurting and the poor. We find him in chapter 5 responding to the needs of the poor. In the midst of a project, he notices the hurting. This past week, I was in a conversation with some friends, and we were talking about, hey, what's if we could ask for one thing that we really need, what's one thing that we need to give greater attention to in our life, or what's one thing that we really need to go after? And one of my friends said, the one thing I want more of in my life is I want to be more aware of the needs of the hurting around me. If I asked you, hey, what's one thing you want more of in your life? You know, oh, I want more money, or I want a new car. I want to be more aware of the needs of the hurting around me is what my friend said. I was reminded again of why I think so highly of this friend of mine. That was her response. She didn't use this language, but essentially what she was saying was, I want to be a Nehemiah. Because Nehemiah, in the midst of a lot of things going on, still was aware of and responded to the needs of the poor. How often do we get so consumed with our thing that we get the blinders on and we don't notice the people in the margins that are hurting? Nehemiah, as we'll see in a moment, is a tremendously focused leader, but his focus never allowed him to take his eyes off the hurting. Which brings us back to chapters 4 and 6, because it's kind of part 1 and part 2 of a story here. Beginning of chapter 4, it says, when Sanballat, one of the other rulers or leaders in the area, when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became angry and was greatly incensed. He ridiculed the Jews. In the presence of his associates in the army of Samaria, he said, what are those feeble Jews doing? Will they restore their wall? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they finish in a day? Can they bring the stones back to life from those heaps of rubble, burned as they are? Tobiah, the Ammonite, who is at his side, said, what are they building? Even a fox climbing up on it would break it down, would break down their walls of stone. So they're angry that this wall's being built, and they're putting them down. And then you jump over to chapter 6, and it continues. Verse 1 of chapter 6, when word came to Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem, the Arab, and the rest of our enemies that I had rebuilt the wall and not a gap was left in it, though up to that time I had not set the doors in the gates, Sanballat and Geshem sent me this message. Come, let us meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono. If you've seen The Godfather, yeah, they're inviting somebody out. We just want to get lunch. But they were scheming to harm me, so I sent messengers to them with this reply. I am carrying on a great project and cannot go down. Why should I stop? Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you? 4 times they sent the same message, and each time I gave them the same answer. Each time I gave them the same answer. I am carrying on a great project and cannot go down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you? I am carrying on a great project. God has called me to do something, and I'm in the midst of doing it. Why would I stop to go have lunch with you? He is not unnecessarily sidetracked. God has called him to a project. He has spent time in prayer and discernment, and God has called him to help rebuild the wall, and so he's doing it. And when they say, hey, come down to Ono, let's have a sandwich together, he goes, no, why should I come down off this ladder? God's called me to do this, and I'm not going to stop for you. Now, you might think, wait a second, in chapter 5, he was sidetracked by the needs of the poor. Wait a second, time out. 1, they were his workers. He's caring for his workers well. And secondly, I say unnecessarily, Oh, you take time to care for the poor. I will never say that you are being sidetracked unnecessarily. But when it comes to what these other people, his opposition wants to do, he is not unnecessarily sidetracked. He goes, no, I'm going to keep doing this. Here at Community Covenant Church, we're building a wall. It's a wall that's built on connecting and growing and serving. This is what we're about. Multiple people have spent time before the Lord praying, God, what are you calling us as a church to be about? And we came up with three words: connecting, growing, serving. This is what we do. This is the wall we are building. We're about connecting with God and with other people. We're about growing closer to God and growing closer to one another. We're about serving God as we serve other people. This is what we do. There will be opposition to this task, and we will be tempted to come down off the wall. May we have the wisdom of Nehemiah to say, wait a second, we're part of a great project. Why would we come down off of that wall? Now, by the time you get to the end of chapter 6, it says that they completed the wall. In 52 days, they completed the wall. I was not here when the addition was built onto the side of this building. I got a hunch it took more than 52 days. Just a little bit more. 52 days. They finished the wall. And then in chapter 7, the exiles return. It's another one of those chapters. It's a list of names. The exiles are returning. And it lists the exiles that are returning. There is a temptation to go, woohoo, hey, story over. Not the case. Wall completed, work unfinished. The wall is completed, the work is unfinished. And you see that by the time they finish the wall at the end of chapter 6, moving into chapter 7, Nehemiah is excited that the wall has been completed, but he realizes, oh, we've just begun. We have just begun. And you see the remainder of the work as it plays out in the next handful of chapters. In chapter 8, there's the reading of the law. Remember, these exiles have been dispersed throughout the kingdom. Who knows the last time or if they had ever heard the law of the Lord, the word of God. So when they all come back together, Ezra and Nehemiah go, hey, this is priority one. We're going to get into the word. Chapter 9, it's all about confession. The people responding to the word of the Lord go, wait a second, this is not how we've been living. They take a time of confession. And then in chapters 10 to 13, you have reform and regression. They set up reform in the kingdom in Jerusalem, and people are like, woohoo, go God, go new way of living. And then they don't have necessarily always live that way. Ain't that the story of my life and yours? Oh yeah, go God, but we don't always live that way. That's what happened in Jerusalem. So here's your quick review. Here's what you find in Nehemiah's story, what you find out about the character and nature of Nehemiah. We find him repeatedly praying to the God of heaven, examination of the condition of the wall, diverse group sharing the mission, caring for the hurting, keeping focus in the midst of opposition, reading scripture, confession, reform. This is all what takes place in the book of Nehemiah. But what you don't find in the book of Nehemiah is this: a miracle. Now we can get into the definition of miracle, but you don't find a miracle. In the book of Nehemiah, you don't see manna from heaven. You don't see the sun standing still so they could work longer in the day. You don't find a burning bush. You don't see the Red Sea parted. You don't see individuals getting delivered out of a fiery furnace. You don't see the mouths of lions being shut. You don't see people walking on water. You don't see the blind receiving sight. You don't see the dead coming back to life. You don't see any miracle in the book of Nehemiah. What you find is a group of people led by Nehemiah who do those things, who do those things. And as a result, watch what God does with those kind of people. When the people of God live that way, oh my goodness, watch what God can do with it. I love this verse in chapter 4. He says, don't be afraid of them, referring to the opposition all around. Don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your families, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your homes. I love what he doesn't say. Nehemiah didn't say, hey, don't be afraid. Remember the Lord. He's going to come through in a big way, and he's going to have lightning bolts from heaven come down, and he's going to be throwing down like hailstones the size of cars. You know, no, he doesn't say that. He says, hey, remember that God is awesome, and God is great, and that should be, give you all the confidence you need. Now go and do the job that you've been called to do. When we as the people of God simply live as God has called us to live, it's amazing what God can accomplish. I love the old story of the individual who went before God, said, God, have you not noticed the suffering in the world around us? And why haven't you done anything? To which God responded to the individual, funny, I was about to ask you the same question. Why are you sitting back waiting for God to throw a lightning bolt from heaven? God's given you what you needed. He's given you his son, Jesus Christ. You've been forgiven and set free from a past you cannot change to a future that is forever changed. He's given you a community. He's given you his spirit. He says, now go. What are you waiting for? Go be my people. And if you think, wait a second, I don't know if I have what it takes. I've read this story to some of you before, but I've always loved it. A number of years ago in a Boston mental institution, there was a young girl who was locked in the dungeon. The doctors had placed little Annie in a small cage that received little light because she was hopelessly insane. At times, Annie would violently attack people who came into her cage. At other times, she would just ignore them. She was destined to spend her whole life in this dreadful place. There was a retired nurse who lived nearby, and she felt that there was hope for any child. So she started visiting the dungeon and trying to communicate some love and hope to the little girl in the cage. When the nurse first started visiting Annie, she acted as if she were not aware of the nurse's presence. One day, the nurse brought some brownies to the dungeon and left them within reach just outside the cage. Little Annie did not respond. But when the nurse returned the next day, the brownies were gone. Every Thursday after that, when the nurse would visit, she would bring brownies and leave them for Annie. Soon after that, the doctors began to notice a dramatic change taking place. They decided to move Annie upstairs. Finally, she was released and told that she could go home, but little Annie didn't leave. She chose instead to stay and help others. Little Annie's full name was Ann Sullivan. And one day she had the opportunity to care for and teach Helen Keller how to communicate with the world she could neither see nor hear. If you don't think you have what it takes to make a difference in the world around you, can you make brownies? God is looking for Nehemiahs. He is looking for people that will spend time praying, that will keep their eyes on the prize, that will fix their eyes on Jesus and not become easily discouraged. Looking for people that take time to do the hard work of self-examination. Looking for people that spend time in the Word and allow that Word to take them to a place of confession and reform. And you've got what it takes. You've got everything you need to be this generation's Nehemiah. We're building a wall, not like the ones you hear about in the news, but a wall built on connecting and growing and serving so we can change the world around us. Would you pray with me, please?